So this is our final talk, final presentation, just on the last few commandments and then on this very, very important theme of forgiveness, reconciliation, and dealing with hurts and wounds. So I think, you know, the first three commandments are vertically oriented towards our relationship with God, and the rest of the commandments are horizontally related to our relationship with each other. Don't kill each other. Be faithful. Don't commit adultery. Don't lie. And now we have don't steal, don't lie, and don't covet. Again, horizontal about our relationship with each other, and really helps us, I think, first to understand what do we mean when we say the word sin. Sin actually comes from the Hebrew word, which generally means to divide, to separate. And that's what Satan does. Satan separates us from one another and from God, and sometimes even from ourselves. Where does sin come from? Well, it comes from the book of Genesis, the very first chapters. And I say something that some people find counterintuitive or challenging, but it's actually true in our history. If you understand the first three chapters of Genesis, if you read the first three chapters and you understand them, you can stop reading. There's nothing else you have to know, not even the New Testament. Because our entire faith is found in those first three chapters as well. As St. Paul says, Jesus is the new Adam, and Mary is the new Eve. We'll see this in the Gospel of the Wedding Feast at Cana at the Gospel today. Jesus refers to Mary. Remember when he says, "Woman, what does this have to do with me?" Remember that? Okay, when he uses that title, woman, that's the title given to Eve. Right? When woman is created, God says, and the name is woman. So Jesus is the new Adam. Mary is the new Eve. If you understand the story of Adam and Eve, you understand everything. So let me just first talk about what was the first sin. So you know this famous story of being in the garden, and you can eat of any tree except this tree, which is, and this is very important to get this title wrong, because people often shorten it, and if you shorten it, you misunderstand it. So it's called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The tree of knowledge of good and evil. You can never shorten it to the tree, the fruit tree. It never says apple. I don't know where that came from. And you can't shorten it to the tree of knowledge. It is the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So why does God say that? Well, first of all, it's not an arbitrary test. Jesus or God is not putting a line in the sand and saying, let me just see if you can just arbitrarily not eat of this tree. Right? It's a very specific name tree, and it's symbolic, and it means that you would know what is right and what is wrong. So God is saying, I don't want you, Adam and Eve, deciding what is right and what is wrong. So let me give you an example. Was this your purse? Not anymore. It's my purse now because it matches my outfit. Now, you might say, but that's wrong. It's my purse. And I'll say, I don't care. It's good for me. And if it's good for me, that's all I need to know. Because I decide what is right and wrong. I decide, not you. I decide what is right and wrong. And it's right for me, so I'm going to take it. Does that make sense? Can you imagine the world that we would live in if every single person would decide what is right and wrong? Right? You could just take things. It's good for me. Right? And this is actually not good for me, so... I mean, how uncomplicated can you get? You know, people have made this story so complicated, and it really is very simple. God is saying, you guys can't decide what is right and wrong. You know, you see this in families with young children. If you come across two little kids arguing and fighting, right? At one point, one of them will look up at you and say, "Make him stop," right? They know at their own level they can't make it happen. They have to kind of go above their level to someone as powerful as you are to make that idiot brother stop, right? So all God is saying in the Garden of Eden is, I have made you a garden. I have made you a wonderful, pleasurable, wonderful place. Enjoy it. Have a good time. But I will decide what is right and wrong, okay? Now, so what is the first sin? The first sin is both Adam and Eve deciding for themselves, no, we will decide what is right and wrong. We will decide what is right and wrong, not you, God. And when that happens, does anybody remember what is the very next story in the gospel, in the story? The very next story after this event is the murder of Cain to Abel. So once people decide what is right and wrong, the next step is murder. You know, welcome to planet Earth. So it's just a very, very powerful story. So the first sin is a sin of selfishness, right? I'm going to decide what's right for me. And all sin is a form of that first sin. No matter what you tell me in confession, it is some form of the first sin in which you are placing your needs, your desires, your wants, your wanting of the purse over the rights of someone else. When I took her purse, I didn't care what she felt. I didn't care what she wanted. I didn't care who belonged. I wanted it. It was good for me. I took it, right? So all sin is some form of that. And so when people tell me all different kinds of sins, I know that the basis of all of it is in some form me over you, right? If I'm committing a sin, it's my needs, my role, my wants, independent of yours. What is the opposite of that is love. Love is, how can I make your life better? How can I make your life happier? How can I make your life more fulfilled, right? So all these ideas are really kind of the basis of what sin and love and the antidote, love, is about. Now, this is a very, very key idea, this whole idea of who decides what is right and wrong. This is the very elemental first story in the gospel, in the Bible, and so you can see it's kind of endemic to our human nature, our human history, throughout human history, and it's very, very present now in this new movement of atheism. Now, you may have family members who say there is no God or that kind of stuff. Don't make any mistake. It is not a theological statement. I will bet $100 that whoever is saying that to you has really very little understanding of theology and almost no understanding of God. Almost 100% of the rise of atheism today is a moral revolt. They don't want anyone telling them what to do, right? They want to decide for themselves what is right and wrong. And they don't want you as a parent, you as a grandparent, me as a clergyman, sisters as religious, church, anyone, government, anyone telling them what to do. When I wrote this book on morality, really in 2002, I mean, coming on 20 years ago, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was a lot smarter than I thought because I titled the book, "Don't Tell Me What to Do." And it becomes kind of the common national anthem of atheism today is, don't tell me what to do. I don't want anyone telling me what to do. If I want to take the purse, I'm going to take the purse. And I don't want anyone saying it. And therein lies, you know, the difficulty. I'm not really bothered by atheism. It's been around a long time. And it just doesn't work. Religion is in our DNA. The way that God made us is already baked into our DNA, and so the world always returns to religion no matter what. And I'm old enough to remember the Soviet Union, which for 70 years used the very finest psychological techniques of propaganda to wipe out religion. Communist China did the same thing under Mao Zedong, Adolf Hitler in Germany, many places like this. And, you know, Soviet Union is gone, Nazi Germany is gone, even Red China is gone. In fact, they say that around the year 2030, China will be the largest Christian nation in the world. Religion is very, very strong in Russia. So it's just in our DNA. It cannot be erased, right? Anyway, so like I mentioned, sometimes people will do things to irritate you, to annoy you. They may do something to hurt you. So how do we react when someone hurts us? We basically have two ways that we react, kind of a commonsensical way. If someone damages us or hurts us or does anything that's damaging, we either defend, put up a defensive wall, avoid, run away, or become silent. That's all defensive. Or we go on the offensive and we attack and get revenge and retribution, right? Rosa, that was the stupidest looking purse I have ever seen. Now, Rosa can do one of two things. She can either clam up, get into her shell and, hunker down and close her ears and just kind of wall me off, right? Or, which is a form of revenge, right? She's cutting off contact. It's an emotional cutoff, right? That's a form of revenge. Or the other thing she can do is attack. And she can say, my purse? What about that stupid sweater you're wearing? Right? That's the attack. And whether you choose one or the other, largely, I think, comes from heredity. I think it comes from modeling that you got from your mom and dad. What you saw them do in response to reactions? Possibly, I think it's largely kind of a learned response. Now, there's actually a goodness in that. When someone hurts you, there is the desire for revenge, but there's something intuitively good about that. And I'm not playing with words here. There's something intuitively good about that, because what you're trying to look for is justice, right? As you hurt me, I want to hurt you. But people have an innate sense of fairness, and they'll say, I want to hurt you just as you hurt me. And then we've balanced the books. And we have a great phrase for that. We say we want to get even, right? That's where that phrase comes from. I want to get even. I don't want to go more. I don't want to go less. I want to do just as what you did to me, because if we get even, that ends it. Doesn't that make sense? So when people snap a revenge, there's actually an inherent goodness in what they're doing. They want to get even. Here's the problem. God designed us in such a way that for whatever reason, we cannot and never will ever be able to read another person's mind, right? You cannot experience the world as another person does. You can look at this red flower over here, and all of us will see a different hue of red than each other. And no matter how many words I describe it to you, you cannot see it in the same way that I do, okay? So we are prisoners of our own experience. So when I hurt Rosa's feelings, she wanted to get even, right? So she fires back at my sweater, but she can't really know if she got even, right? She can't tell, because she can't know if the level of hurt that she felt matches the level of hurt that I felt, right? So generally what people do is they go overboard, right? Well, I instinctively know that what she said about my sweater is not the same thing as what I said about her purse. She was unfair, She didn't get even, she went overboard. So now I have to go back to her. Hey, by the way, not only your purse, but your jacket as well. Okay. You'll never sit in the first row again, will you? So now she feels it's unfair, right? Now she's going to get back at me, and she's going to go overboard with me, and I'm going to go overboard with her, right? So what I'm getting at, and this is a law of the universe, is this is called the cycle of revenge, right? Because she's doing it, I'm doing it, she's doing it, I'm doing it. And the cycle of revenge always escalates. It never goes down. It can't be even, but it always escalates. And it will escalate until someone dies. Or, if we recognize that we've gone too far, it'll stop. But it's still going on in our head. So even though we stop, oh, I've had it with you, and I walk away, you know, I'm muttering to myself, oh, that Rosa, oh my God. So it's still continuing, right? It's still continuing in my head. And so it's revenge that I can't continue. It's frozen revenge. And another word for frozen revenge is resentment. I resent her. Or she resents me. So this typically happens when a cycle of revenge can't continue because it's happening to your boss at work, right? There's only so much you can say. Or neighbors, or maybe a spouse, or children, you know, whatever it is, you know, there's like some cutoff, but the resentment, the revenge and the resentment continues. So Jesus and our faith announces two words that deal with this. And one is forgiveness, and the other is reconciliation. And they are separate words, never to be confused, although they frequently are. But they are completely different words. Now, forgiveness is a very misunderstood word, and it's sometimes resented by people because of the implication of forgetting. And we have this horrible phrase, which is not part of our faith, and has caused a tremendous amount of damage, which is the phrase, forgive and forget. That is simply wrong. And one of the reasons why people sometimes have a difficult time with forgiveness is because it implies that someone does a great injustice to you and you're going to sweep it under the rug, pretend it never happened, or forget about it, right? Somebody just damages your reputation and somebody comes up to you and says, well, forgive and forget. And you go, but my reputation is disaster, is devastated. Oh, but, you know, Jesus says forgive and forget. No, he doesn't. He says forgive. Now, I'm going to give you Jesus' definition of forgiveness, and it is only this. Forgiveness is a decision from the head. It's a decision of no revenge. But we're not friends. And we're not reconciled. And we may never talk again. But I forgive you, which means as you hurt me, I am not going to hurt you. But we haven't found justice yet. Does that make sense? So when Jesus was on the cross, he was looking at the people and saying to his Father, Father in heaven, these people are killing me. I don't want you killing them. But I'm telling you people, we're not reconciled. You shouldn't be killing anyone. So we're not friends. That make sense? The good thief actually became reconciled because he followed the steps of reconciliation. So forgiveness is a one-step decision of the head, which says, I will not seek revenge. And you can do that even while you're being hurt, right? Because it's something from the head. It's a decision. So you're hurting me, I'm not going to hurt you. And I'll tell you a little bit later how you can get to that point. Now, reconciliation is a four-step process. It's a process. And it involves cooperation with the other person. So those are the four steps of reconciliation. And if you think about it, they are perfectly common sense steps that happen naturally as you blurt out things as you're being hurt. So the first step in this issue is forgiveness, okay? Rosa is not gonna strike me on my shoulder. She's not gonna fight back, but she's gonna say, stop it, right? Second thing is, a beautiful thing is, what'd you do that for? We need an explanation, right? What was the reason for that? The third is a promise of amendment, don't do it again. And if there has been any damage, injustice, you have to repair it, right? So those are the four steps. I have all this in the article up here, so if you don't have to write them down if you don't want, but I have everything in this article up here on forgiveness and reconciliation. And it's actually called Forgiveness is Not Forgetting. Because it's not forgetting, because you can't reconcile if you forgot everything, right? So reconciliation is a process that involves time, involves the other person, in which they stop, they give an explanation of why they did it, they say they won't do it anymore, and they repair any damage. That second step is important. It's a natural thing when something happens that we don't understand. God designed us human beings. This is the birth of science. This is why science is what human beings do. So we want to know, why did that happen, right? The sun comes up in the morning. Why is that? There's going to be an eclipse of the moon tonight. You know, why is that? Something happens you don't understand. Why is that? Father Dave hits Rosa on the shoulder. Why is that? You know, I have my reasons, but, you know, no. So these are the four steps of reconciliation. Now, sometimes you find out if you have a chance to say, why did you do that? And then the person gives you an explanation, you may find out that it was a complete misunderstanding. You know, I may say, Rosa, you had a deadly lizard on your shoulder. I was swatting the lizard, you know. I mean, it could be something completely innocent that you thought was horrible, and it turns out to be an innocent explanation. So going through the steps of reconciliation can actually resolve an issue that you thought was horrible and it turns out to be something that you didn't realize. Does that make sense? So forgiveness is a step of no revenge. Reconciliation is all these steps. Now, what happens if the person who hurt you is dead? Well, you're not going to be able to reconcile that in the depth that you would like. What happens if the person doesn't want to talk? You're not going to be able to reconcile as much as you like. You can forgive anyone instantly at the moment. Reconciliation may or may not happen depending on the circumstances and availability and cooperation of the other person. And that's just the way it goes. You may not be able to get the explanation. Maybe the person is just truly mean. In that case, you have every right to say, for safety's sake, I will not be around you. You are too dangerous to be around, right? That make sense? So there's nothing unchristian about that. How do we get to this stage where, someone can hurt us and we can have this kind of presence of mind to not be hurt? And I want to tell you this story because it's just really, really important, this whole idea of how not to be hurt in the first place. And it's the origin of the famous story where Jesus says, turn the other cheek, which is also one of the most misunderstood stories of all. It's not a story of victimhood at all. But I'll tell you, this is a true story of myself. it didn't happen to me, but I observed it. When I was young, I grew up in Thousand Oaks, which was a large bedroom community with very few summer jobs available for kids. And I'm in the seminary, which was a boarding school. So by the time I got out in late May, all of the indoor air-conditioned jobs were already taken. Thousand Oaks is very hot in the summer, and so I ended up working in a lumber yard. manual labor. Extremely difficult, extremely hard. But also, the lumberyard tended to employ very, very problematic people, right? Ex-cons, felons, prisoners on the run from the law, mental cases from Vietnam, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, drug addicts, just a really rough group. So I was working in this lumberyard with ex-cons, felons, Vietnam vets, and me, a seminarian, right? And, you know, people didn't work there very long. You know, there was kind of a rotation. Sometimes the police would show up and take one of them away, you know, and the boss would come out and say, well, Ernie doesn't work here anymore, you know. And I worked there about 7 summers, right? And because turnover was high, after a few summers, I was the veteran, right? I was the old man. You know, I was the guy that was the stable guy that was there all the time, and we had people coming in and out. And I remember this one year that we heard that the lumberyard had been sold, and there was a new owner, and there were going to be some layoffs. Psychologically, that brings up a lot of tension, a lot of anxiety, which gets directed to the weakest member. And it was the most recently hired young kid who everybody else tried to get that one fired or that one laid off. So they made him look bad all day long. They insulted him. They made fun of him. They belittled him. They cheated. They made him look bad in front of the boss, in front of customers and all this. And to my chagrin and to my shame, I never did anything about it. I didn't come to his defense. I just minded my own business, if you will. But they really, really mistreated this guy really badly. The thing that struck me, though, was that he took it all so well. He never sought revenge. He never fought back. He always seemed to be in a good mood. He never took it personally. He never got upset. And they really, really mistreated him. So I was working with him one day, and I said, I have to ask you, everybody here treats you so badly. They insult you, they lie about you, they cheat, they embarrass you, they humiliate you. You never get upset. Doesn't it bother you that everyone treats you so badly? He said, no, not really. You see, I'm the son of the new owner. I said, really? Remember, I am your closest personal friend. So, a true story. And I never forgot that. It was just a riveting example of, you know, if you have a special connection with the boss, what do you care what the other employees say, right? If you have a special connection with the boss, what does it matter what other people say about you, right? That's the key. If you have a very, very powerful connection with our Lord, that is incredibly empowering, right? You feel incredibly loved. You feel incredibly cherished. You feel incredibly wanted. You feel incredibly respected. So that when someone insults you, it's water off a duck's back. Because somebody bigger, larger, and more powerful has told you already that day who you are. Your dignity as a person comes from God, not that jerk over there. That make sense? That's the origin of the meaning of this, again, very difficult phrase, passage in the Gospels that talk about if somebody strikes you on the right cheek, turn and offer the left, right? So let me demonstrate that.
Now, look at the interesting detail. Look at the interesting detail in that gospel. It doesn't say if someone strikes you. It says if someone strikes you on the right cheek. Point to your right shoulder. Take your time. You can think of your own right cheek right now, right? Now, for me to strike her on the right cheek, normally with the right hand, I can't do it, right? It's on the wrong side. So what that gospel references is not a violent strike, it's a backhand strike, right? So if someone strikes you on the right cheek, it's a Hebrew technical phrase that means if someone backhands you. That is not a violent strike, that is an insulting strike. Someone does this, that's an insult. Somebody wants to really hurt you, they'll do the right hook. If they want to insult you, they'll stop you this way. So what Jesus is saying is, if someone insults your dignity, since your dignity comes from me, that person can't insult your dignity because they don't own it. I own it. Does that make sense? So the slap is not taken as a wound. Now, then he says, turn and offer the left. And that's when he's saying, you want to fight? I will respond, right? Because if you strike my left cheek, that is a violent attack, and I will respond. But the right cheek, no need to respond, right? Now, the fact of the matter is, very rarely is anyone going to physically attack you, right? So you don't have to worry about the left cheek issue. But people will all day long slap you on the right cheek by insulting you or belittling you or belittling your faith. You know, why do you believe in that Catholic idiot stuff? You know, that kind of, all these kind of phrases that people might use. You don't take it personally. You don't take it personally. Because your dignity comes from God. So another example is I was counseling a woman who came in who was married to a very abusive, emotionally abusive husband. You're a stupid wife, you're a stupid cook, you're a stupid mother, you're a stupid woman, you're a stupid this, you're stupid that. Very, very belittling. Very difficult for her. I changed the subject just to change the tone a little bit, and I said, you're a teacher, aren't you? And she goes, yes, a fourth grade teacher. Oh, well, tell me about your class. And then she brightened up. Oh, I love my class. I love teaching. I love my students. I said, tell me about today. She says, well, you know, we collected homework, and one of our boys didn't have his homework. So I said, what did you do? I said, well, I gave him more homework. What did he do? He said, well, he had a tantrum, and he started calling me names. You're a lousy teacher. I said, what did you do then? I said, well, I kind of laughed to myself and gave him more homework. I said, isn't that interesting? He used the exact same language as your husband. Your husband and the kid both said, you're a lousy teacher. When your husband said it, you went into depression. When the kid said it, you laughed and responded in a mature way. And she said, well, the kid is an airhead fourth grader. I said, you're married to an airhead fourth grader. Well, the light bulb went off, and she said, yes, anyone who acts like an airhead fourth grader is an airhead fourth grader. Remember the example I gave yesterday about who is my brother and my sister, but those people who act like that, right? So this the gentleman might be 30 in his 30s, but he's acting like an airhead fourth grader, so he is, right? Anyone who would call a fellow human being stupid is a child himself. Does that make sense? So from that point on, this woman never took anything he said seriously. She would laugh to herself, right? So you know what happened? He realized he was no longer getting away with things. People tend to do what they get away with. And once his comments had no impact, no effect, he stopped. You know, not always is that the case, but most of the time it is. So again, she wasn't trying to change him. She changed herself, and because she had a different reaction to things, her life became different.
Does that make sense? It's no accident that our entire weekend has been about changing ourselves, not changing the idiots around us, but changing ourselves and our reaction to them. So when people insult you or they make fun of your faith or, you know, what'd you go on that stupid retreat for? Just laugh to yourself and give them more homework. No, you just laugh to yourself and say, and actually this is my favorite phrase to say, if somebody says something insulting to you, rather than hide behind a wall or attack, the most very, very beautiful thing that you can say is, thank you for your thoughts. The nice thing about that is that it is not attacking and you're not defending, right? You're basically saying, I don't care what you think, right? But you're saying it in a way that's unoffensive. Thank you for your thoughts. You know, I don't believe in God. Thank you for your thoughts. I think it's stupid that you go to Mass. Thank you for your thoughts. You know, you're a horrible mother. Thank you for your thoughts. You've done so many things wrong. Thank you for your thoughts. Or you can, anything like that. You know, thank you for sharing, you know. And all of these are ways that God designed us to be empowered. Now, I'll just end with this, that remember the final commission was to go out into the world, and Jesus knew that the world was filled with airhead fourth graders. And so he was empowering his apostles, disciples, to be autonomous, independent people that could actually mix with all kinds of different people and retain their balance, retain their self-respect with these beautiful phrases of that he talks about in the Gospels. So it's quite possible to go through the day. People do all kinds of hurtful things, but you don't take them as hurtful. Right? Because you have spent a great deal of day connecting with our Lord. So I'll just end with this idea of how best to do that. Because I said you'll never get hurt if you have this strong connection with our Lord. So let me just talk about how you actually get that. If you travel to some country or some place you haven't been before, one of the fun things to do is to see something that you haven't seen before, and you turn to your friend and you say, hey, look at that. What do you think of that? That's amazing. Never knew it was so high, so big, so tall, so this or that, whatever it is, you know, Eiffel Tower. How? Hey, look at that. Okay, so that's kind of having a travelogue, a travel companion, right? You have a travel companion in which you are commenting on what you see to your travel companion. Sometimes you don't like what you see. Sometimes you do like what you see. Sometimes you have no opinion, but you're sharing it with your travel companion, right? And it's a nice, you kind of express yourself that way, and you become very good at expressing yourself, of having, seeing something and putting it to words and make it intelligible to someone else. I cannot think of a better way to spend the entire day than doing that with our Lord, to kind of conceive of Jesus as your traveling companion, in which you are constantly commenting on what you see and hear with your traveling companion. This is what St. Paul calls unceasing prayer, to pray unceasingly. It doesn't mean that you say 1 million Hail Marys, which you can. But another way is simply to continue to be talking to our Lord throughout the day. It's also important to remember that there is no such thing as an inappropriate topic. So that unceasing prayer will keep you solid. That'll keep you connected to the owner. If you're connected to the owner, it doesn't matter what other people say. You will have that habit of speaking with our Lord all day long, that unceasing prayer. And it will make for your day to be very peaceful, no matter who you are with.